Welcome to this special podcast episode produced jointly with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine. My name is Dr. Danny Bryden. I'm a consultant in intensive care medicine in Sheffield and Dean of the Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine. I was also one of the working party for the Academy of Royal College's guidance on the code of practice for the diagnosis of confirmation of death. With me today are two clinicians, Dr. Dale Gardner and Dr. Ian Thomas. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves and a little bit of their background. So first of all, Dale, hello.
Thank you, Danny. So hi, I'm Dr. Dale Gardner. So I'm an intensive care doctor in Nottingham. I'm on the Faculty of Intensive Care Board and chair the Faculty's Professional Affairs and Safety Committee. Like Danny, I was actually co-chair of the Code of Practice for Diagnosing and Confirmation of Death from the Academy. And also I'm the Associate Medical Director for Deceased Organ Donation. So these topics are very close to me.
Thank you. And Ian, hello.
Hi, Danny. So my name's Ian Thomas. I'm a consultant in adult intensive care medicine in Bristol, and I'm a member of the Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine Legal and Ethical Professional Unit. I also work with Dale with NHS Blood and Transplant as the Southwest Clinical Lead for Organ Donation. I have an interest in all matters to do with death, and it's a fascinating subject to discuss. And thank you for the opportunity to share it and discuss it with yourself and Dale this afternoon.
Thank you. I think we're all going to learn something from each other this afternoon, hopefully. So in this episode, we're going to be looking at when and how to diagnose death for the purposes of a number of reasons, including organ donation. But this podcast isn't going to focus on organ donation per se, but it will hopefully help your understanding as clinicians if you have to do work in this area. And we're going to look at the implications of the recent changes to the guidance issued by the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges, particularly for those of us that are working as anaesthetists or intensivists. So first of all, I'd like to start with something that probably sounds patently obvious, but maybe a little bit more tricky, and that's around a definition. So Dale, what do you think is a definition of death, or how might we go about defining it?
Yeah, fantastic question, Danny. And you would have thought after all of human history that this would be just a really simple thing to answer. And historically, potentially, it was when, you know, death was not moving, decomposition, mammalian way of knowing. You know, even mammals will know when one of their herd has died. So what's different about us? I think as technologies evolved, particularly resuscitation, we have sort of really separated the moments of death. That death is actually a process, and during that process, different organs and cells are actually decomposing, stopping at different rates. So we need to choose that moment. And over the, particularly with the advent of anesthesia and intensive care and ventilators, we've even separated that moment even more, that process where we can maintain function in some parts of the body, but not the most important part, the brain. And I think that's really what takes us to what are those essential features of us as human beings. And ultimately, what we've been saying for a long time in the UK and supported from around the world, that actually it's probably the permanent cessation of consciousness and the permanent cessation of the capacity to breathe. And if you anatomically ask yourself, where are those capacities located? Well, one, their brain, but particularly their brain stem, with the medulla oblongata allowing us to breathe and the reticular activating system being the sort of on off, the beginning, the rudimentary building blocks. And what this new code is, it brings everything together and reinforces that aspect that death is the permanent loss of capacity to breathe, permanent loss of capacity of consciousness, anatomically located to the brain stem.
Great, thanks. Ian, as a clinician, I think, how do you feel about explaining death to relatives? Do you feel that it's something we can do well?
Well, I think, Danny, to be able to explain it to people, we have to understand it. And in my experience, the definition of death that Dale's just been referring to there is actually probably not that well recognised by clinical colleagues. And it's interesting, as Dale has said, the process of dying There's a binary state, being alive and being dead. You can't coexist a bit of both. You can only be in one state or the other. And the end point of the dying process is death. And within the medical profession, we need to be able to identify exactly at what point, at what moment that death has occurred. Because once somebody has been diagnosed and confirmed as dead, it completely changes, not only from a clinical perspective of what our, aims of therapeutic interventions are, but also at a societal and legal level, at a cultural level, it completely changes. So there's wide societal importance of the medical profession being able to state with certainty once death has occurred and that patient is dead, because then it allows us to do certain things such as disposal of the body, exploration of end-of-life choices such as organ donation. And as Dale was saying there about the definition of death, it too has evolved, and we've moved very much away from an anatomical basis of what death is to a functional basis now, where it's those two key characteristics that are required for human existence, the capacity to breathe and the capacity for consciousness, that once permanently lost, signify the death of an individual.
Yeah, thanks. I think it gets quite interesting, doesn't it? Because it reminds me a little bit of some of the particle physicists who also are part-time philosophers. This concept of when does something exist or no longer exist, and how long does a subatomic particle have to be in existence for? Once you start thinking about it, you can tie yourselves in knots quite a bit. Dale, what do you think are the sorts of things that people tie themselves in knots about and get wrong in their heads?
Well, I think ultimately, we should remember why were doctors asked to make the diagnosis of death? Why not, as it was historical, families made it or religious leaders? And I think because we can bring some science to it, because we can apply the diagnostic criteria, where you've got a set of investigations and history that you, or even examination that we can bring to it to create the diagnostic process. So that we can actually then, with confidence, and this is why doctors in the 1900s were asked to actually, 19th century, were asked to lead on this, because previously it hadn't been, because we could apply that science to it, and we can therefore diagnose death in an accurate, standardized, and most importantly, so that we don't have to wait for decomposition like the mammals did in the ancient times. We can also be timely in the diagnosis. So I think people tie themselves into knots by seeing it as something different than what it is. I diagnose death in the same way I diagnose pneumonia or a myocardial infarction. I have a set of criteria, and in this case, the set of criteria for death is given by the Academy Code of Practice. And I match the history, the examination, and investigations I've done against those. And that's the safety. And to get it back to what we do every day, rather than being some sort of mystical thing, it has importance, and it has spiritual importance for many people in our society. But what we do as doctors in this process is very clear cut. It's a diagnosis.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm just thinking back to, might be showing my age a bit, my own days at medical school, which actually I was never taught how to diagnose death. And I was a qualified doctor, I think, and just sent to go and see people and confirm whether or not they were dead. It's changed quite a bit, certainly over in my clinical career. What do you think the new academy guidance has within it that is worth flagging up to anaesthetists and intensivists that they may not have thought about before? Dale?
So we've been really explicit in the code of who can make the diagnosis, and also that what the criteria are. So in the who category, it might be a surprise that there's nothing in law that says who can make a diagnosis of death. But we've sort of giving sort of guidance on who they are. So it begins with somatic criteria, where if someone is clearly, obviously deceased, you don't go into a museum and see a skeleton and begin CPR. You know they're deceased. There, sort of anyone can make that diagnosis. Scenes of accidents. Obviously, you've got to be a bit careful with some of them, but mainly it's very obvious. Then there's the circulatory criteria. We need competence in a stethoscope. And more we've seen changes in the nursing staff are have their own guidance based on sort of the Academy's sort of foundation on how to diagnose death after that cardiorespiratory arrest. And then we've got the neurological criteria, where we very much still stand to what people were taught, that it has to be 5 years post registration. One of the people have to be a consultant and competent to do the testing. So we're sort of really got covering the who, and then the what they do. We've been really explicit now, even more so than previously. It'll surprise everyone that until 2008, there was no guidance on how to diagnose death after cardiorespiratory arrest that I'd ever seen nationally in the UK or in my home country of Australia. We'd ever, like Danny, I was taught to, my registrar said, go up, listen to the heart for a minute, look in the eyes, and if you can't see anything happening, they're dead. That was it. And we've moved a long way. And because errors have crept in and people have made mistakes, and the code of practice is really designed to minimize any risk of that. So a 5 minutes observation after cardiorespiratory arrest and a neurological criteria. The big changes, I think, is you'll see that why can you be dead in the UK, but not dead in the USA, and not maybe dead or not dead in Australia? Like, it's all blurring, and we need more towards consensus. And we're working. There was a group in 2020 called the World Brain Death Project, who really set out how we can come together as a world. And so, in the codes, neurological criteria, we've tried as much as we possibly can to align ourselves to that, which is why the apnea test has changed to actually ask for a higher rise than what we had previously. Not because we were worried about it, but with all the international movement of doctors, and also to avoid this thing of dead in one country, not another, let's all have a worldwide definition of death, hopefully in the next 10, 20 years. And we're doing our bit to step towards that.
Great, thanks. Ian, and I've got a question for you, which is, if you're an anaesthetist who doesn't do intensive care practice and perhaps does mostly elective type lists, why, how would you say as an anaesthetist that it's important to know about the guidance?
If you are not working within an intensive care environment, or you're not on a in a ward-based role, then the requirement for you to diagnose or confirm death is going to be pretty limited. But anaesthetists will have a role within theatre if where appropriate, for instance, during organ retrieval for the purposes of transplantation. And clearly, once we start moving towards deceased organ donation, then we have to have certainty that death has been diagnosed and confirmed correctly. And so, if an anaesthetist involvement, either in following organ donation, following either death by circulatory criteria or neurological criteria, having an understanding of how that process has been undertaken and to ensure that it's been done safely and correctly, I think is important in that respect for the anaesthetic community to have that understanding of death as well. Just coming back to some of the things that Dale was saying there, Danny, I find it peculiar that whether you're alive or dead, which sounds to say singularly human, depends on where you are in the world. And indeed within countries it can depend on which province or which states you're in. There are different definitions depending on where you are. And if you are unfortunate enough to be in a condition clinical state where death is suspected in one country in Europe, it will be different if you're somewhere else. And I think the international community recognizes that the importance of trying to align and find consensus and agreement, but it's not straightforward by any stretch. And we can see from our colleagues in North America that there is ongoing discussion around revision of guidance for the diagnosis of death in the United States of America, for instance. So I think we, as Dale was saying there, we've aligned ourselves with colleagues in elsewhere in the world, like Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and that World Brain Death Project, trying to pull it all together, I think is a big step forward.
I certainly found it interesting to be part of the group. There were a lot of people with a lot of very different perspectives, philosophers, lawyers, clinicians, and those different perspectives of something that we take to be self-evident do sometimes make you think quite deeply about what you've taken for granted in the past. I would just ask the post both of you, I suppose. I'll start with Ian and then go to Dale. Ian, what would you flag up to people as different this time in the new guidance, previous iterations, or things that people may feel they've understood in the past?
Well, I think it's offering additional clarity. It's recognizing the importance of language and, also giving, as Dale mentioned there, a very robust set of criteria for the diagnosis to be made with safety and certainty. And I think it's an important document that all clinicians should read. And have an understanding of what we're talking about is that there is only one definition of death. There are just three different sets of criteria that you can reach that definition, if you like, such as Dale has mentioned, they're somatic, and the two that we would perhaps be more involved with as clinicians within a hospital environment, which is circulatory criteria and neurological criteria. And you hear terminology used interchangeably, which, particularly when we're talking about the diagnosis and confirmation of death using circulatory criteria, and you hear the phrase cardiac death, for instance, and that to me demonstrates perhaps a lack of understanding of what we're actually talking about, because in the context of the diagnosis and confirmation of death following cardiorespiratory arrest, which is perhaps what the general public think of as death most commonly, what we're not talking about there is we're talking about absence of circulation. We're not talking about absence of cardiac function. Because one of the questions I sometimes pose to an audience when we're talking about this is it possible to be alive without a heart? And that raises eyebrows, and people look at it and then they think about it and they think you're trying to ask them a trick question, which you're not. You're just asking them, do they really understand what death is if you can be alive without a heart? And of course, the answer is yes, you can be. With the advances in medical technology that Dale was referring to in intensive care environments, such as extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, I mean, during a heart transplant, there will be a point where a patient is acardic, yet they are not dead, even though they have no heartbeat. But that is because their circulation is being continued, albeit with artificial support. And that really demonstrates, and I think really helps understanding about its absence of circulation to the brainstem, which we are using as a surrogate marker of permanent loss of brainstem function, which leads to that clinical state that we recognize as death. So I think the choice of language, the clarity, the understanding is crucial as medical professionals. And it's the very least that society expects is for us as healthcare professionals to be able to state with certainty when somebody has died.
And I would sort of say as well, personally, from speaking to relatives, if we're not sure about the diagnosis and the criterion and we're not careful with the language, it becomes incredibly difficult to then explain to relatives consistently what's actually going on, because it just leads to more confusion. So knowing the accuracy of the language and the rationale becomes really important. I would like to move on a little bit, Dale, perhaps to explore some of the other aspects, particularly the diagnosis of death using neurological criteria. So again, just to flag up for those of us working in anaesthesia or intensive care, what would you flag up to people as different this time?
Yeah, no, thanks, Danny. So, just to bring sort of the previous conversation and that question together, I think one of the key helps we had on the latest code is the lay involvement and the challenges that they brought to us to really articulate in clear ways. Because as we just said, it's not that you have to understand it, you have to make a safe diagnosis, but you also have to be able to explain it. And we've done a lot in the new code in that area. There's a whole section now, a brand new section on communication around the time of death. People, we have a lot of help on talking about end of life care and other aspects, but this is about actually, what do you say at the time? Where are you? How do you communicate it? There's a whole new section, and that was very much driven by the lay members of the Code of Practice working group. The other thing is we made a big effort to encourage that clinicians feel brave enough to let families observe clinical testing for neurological criteria. I know it's not easy, but when I began asking families earlier in my practice, 50-50 families would accept. But now it's up to 80-90% of times I have families observing, usually the second set of clinical tests. clearly they're not changing. I'm changing. It's my, grown in confidence with that. And I think it shows you pull the curtains back. It shows you've got nothing to hide. And the old saying of seeing is believing. What's really interesting in my practice has how, and we've encouraged this, it's not always the nearest relative. It can be like a representative from the family. It can be really helpful for their understanding and trust, because we know trust in the NHS is at a low ebb now, and anything we can do to rebuild that. And probably the most substantial change in the code was something that people have been calling for decades. And that is the odd situation the UK got itself into, whereby death, we do two sets of clinical tests, but the time of death was timed to the first set of clinical tests, even though you wouldn't say they're dead until you finish the second set. And that led to enormous confusion, trying to explain that to families about legal death or not legal death. And that, and especially as families now are starting to be there for the second set of tests, then they're not there at the first. We're the only one in the world who was doing that. And it really came out because in the very earliest codes in 1976, they said it was customary to do two sets of tests. Then it was you should nevertheless. The next code said you should. And 2008, we said you must. And we were still in the must do two sets of tests. So it made a lot of sense. And everywhere I've mentioned around the country, and Ian would agree, we've brought this. Everyone said, oh, about time. So in the new code, once your doctor knows all they need to know to say someone is dead, so that's in neurological criteria after the second set of tests, that's when you're dead. So I hope the community welcomes this a chance to bring it into something more family focused and also more logical.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly created a lot of confusion. I remember being challenged, well, if you've already said they're dead, why are you doing a second set of tests? And it was a bit kind of like, because I have to.
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
So just going on from that then, and the testing, and there was a lot of discussion with the lawyers. Do you think that there's going to be any challenge around this from the courts in terms of exploring this change? Because we did get some confident reassurance, didn't we?
Indeed. So what's interesting in the court case is there has been legal challenge to the concept of neurological criteria over decades, but increasingly in more recent times, it's happening more often. And the courts have been very clear that, as they say, brainstem death is death in the UK. And that came from the Tony Bland case, where they were very clear in the House of Lords that because Tony Bland, who was in a persistent vegetative state or a vegetative state, still had a blood supply to his brainstem, and this brainstem was working, that he was alive. And on that basis, the courts have been very clear. The second aspect is the courts often verbatim quote the Academy Code of Practice. And they're not just the one before this one, the 2008 one. Even before that, they were using the codes of practice and medical opinion for that. I like to use the analogy that judges wear black robes, not white coats. They don't want to be making the diagnosis of death. What they want to do is to be judging the law and judging. And from that, from a common law perspective, they are happy to look to professional groups, especially something where all the medical royal colleges come together as the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges and give a guidance. And our guidance is fantastic in the UK because it covers all deaths. Many other guidances around the world are only for the purposes of organ donation, and that leads to confusion about whether you can be neurological criteria only apply in that circumstance. But for us, all deaths in the UK, the Academy gives guidance for. So I think the courts will support this, and we'll look forward to that, when that comes. And challenge will arise, but to date, the courts have been very supportive.
Ian, do you have any blood to add?
Yeah, no, I think it's worth stating, Danny, that there is no legal definition of death in the United Kingdom. If you went to a law textbook and would try to find it out, or spoke to a colleague from the law profession, there is no legal definition of death. It is very much that the law looks at what the professional bodies recommend, and in this case, it'd be the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges, and basically asks, has the guidance been followed as best possible practice. And where that has been undertaken, then, as Dale said, the courts are fully supportive of the medical position. Well, I think it's interesting when you look, and there have been challenges to the diagnosis of death using neurological criteria, but to me, it's not the definition of death that's being challenged. It's the method used to reach it. So nobody's ever gone to court and said that patient who had a diagnosis of death by circulatory criteria 12, 24, 36 hours ago is not dead. Yeah, it's the neurological criteria, 36, 48, 72 hours, even longer, that the court cases are coming, where the and we need to be sensitive to, cultural and religious interpretations of what death is, rather than the actual definition itself. And I think that's an interesting point. And there are cases in, and there are places in the world where that is acknowledged, and the diagnosis of death by neurological criteria is not recognized by some faith groups, and that has been supported, for instance, in, and there is facility for that within the legal system in places like New Jersey in America. But at the moment, that doesn't exist within the UK.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, actually, because as clinicians, as medics, I think we often put too much emphasis on the statute element of law as providing the answers for us and providing a framework that has never really been there. And actually, that pushes back onto us the importance of doing the medical aspects correctly. The parallel I always draw is that there's no definition of murder, actually, statutory definition of murder. It's just the unlawful killing of a human being under the king's peace. That's all that exists. So, we have to get comfortable with doing the doctoring bit and the medical bit, I think, and get familiar with that. Ian, you've mentioned a little bit about some of the challenges around diagnosis of death by neurological criteria. But moving on to kind of organ donation aspect in your role, do you think the guidance has any implications for those working in the field of organ donation?
I think the first point to make there, Danny, is that the diagnosis and confirmation of death, whether it be by circulatory or neurological criteria, is an ITU-based diagnosis, certainly with the, when it comes to death by neurological criteria, and that then facilitates a particular form of organ retrieval and transplantation as per the patient's pre-stated wishes. So we need to be very clear that there is a separation between the diagnosis of death by neurological criteria and organ donation. The purpose of that diagnosis is not purely to facilitate organ donation. So I think what we can take with the updated guidance from the Academy, and also the cases that have gone between before the courts, is that as an intensive care community, if we follow that guidance, then we will have safety, certainty, and the backing of the legal profession, should it ever be required, that that diagnosis of death is safe and has been made in accordance with best practice. So I think that's the key point, is that we follow the guidance as a community, then we can have absolute confidence that the diagnosis has been made correctly. And it's only then that a particular organ retrieval can then go ahead for the purposes of transplantation. So in terms of the organ donation community, I don't think the guidance really changes anything, because what we need as within the organ donation community is to have safety and confidence in the diagnosis and confirmation of death. And if it has been made in accordance with the Academy guidance, then we can certainly have that and allow organ retrieval and transplantation to proceed.
So I'll move on to Dale then, because the guidance has been in effect for 6 or 7 weeks now. And I guess now would be the time when we might start to see any early queries or teething problems. Are there anything at this stage that you would want to point out to people that maybe are leading to some confusion or some lack of understanding around the guidance?
So the interplay, the way most of us will interact with the code of practice, I will hope you will read, people will read it. But when it comes to neurological criteria, the people will approach it, have it with the testing forms, the multi-professionally endorsed testing forms, which are hosted on the Faculty of Intensive Care's website. And that'll be your go-to. It acts as an aide memoire, it double checks, You can have them visible for families observing you. And the good feedback we've had is that actually they're very clear and people are finding it easy to follow, which is fantastic, particularly in the apnea test. So just to remind the audience, just some numbers, we used to have to get to the carbon dioxide to 6 kilopascals, and then we had to rise over 5 minutes by a minimum of 0.5. And there were some other caveats, but it used to be quite hard to get to 6 because you had to readjust the ventilator. And also it was only a moderate rise. But now we're going to start at 5.3 kilopascals, which is aligning to the rest of the world. And we have to get to 8 kilopascals, so which most times we did in the past. But the key change is we have to do rise by 2.7 kilopascals. Why 2.7? What a crazy number. Well, 20 millimeters of mercury. It's all American. So in the past, when it was like 45 millimeters of mercury and you're in the States and it's got to rise by 20, 65, easier. And we're now it's if I said this the CO2 is 5.45 as now it's 2.7 higher. Oh, I can't do that in my head. Maybe a few of the listeners can. And we teach, use a calculator because it's in kilopascals, it's much harder. I thought this was going to be a challenge for people. It's not been. People have really done it well. The testing form is really didactic. Write down your starting CO2, work out what it is, add 2.7 to it and write that number, and then wait for the blood gas to reach that number. And all the ones I've reviewed in the last 6 weeks have done perfect, perfect, perfect. So I'm really pleased. There is always a little sort of typos on these things and little things of clarity, which we'll be hoping to get to in time. But I've been actually really pleased with how things are.
And Ian, is everybody in your unit going okay with the guidance, do you think?
Well, it's obviously there was a quite a frantic process on the 31st of December to the 1st of January to make sure that all the correct paperwork was in place and that old forms weren't left lingering around. But no, I think the feedback that we've received is that if the form is extremely helpful because it leads you through literally step by step. Now, the diagnosis of death by neurological criteria in some units is a reasonably common occurrence in our colleagues in big neuro intensive care units. But the patient may not be in a neuro intensive care unit. And if you're working in a smaller district general hospital, it may be that you don't undertake neurological death testing more than once every 5, 6, 7 years, depending on the patient presentation and how it interacts with your shifts, etc. So to be able to have such a comprehensive guide for something that is perhaps unusual in your working practice, I think is extremely helpful. Because if something's unusual, it can become something that you're less engaged with, you're less likely to undertake. But actually, having something like that form, which, if you follow it literally step by step, will take you through and ensure that that diagnosis and confirmation is made safely. And I think if there are queries, which there will be, there's no form that can ever be written that will cover all clinical circumstance. And as Dale and I are finding out that there are new queries that are new questions that crop up every so often. Is phone a colleague in perhaps your local neuro intensive care unit where they will almost certainly have greater experience and be able to provide support and guidance to a practitioner where it is a less frequent undertaking.
That's great. That's a really good piece of advice. Phone a friend who does it more often if you're not sure. And there's no shame in saying that you're not sure. I'm going to finish by asking both of you for a little sort of key takeaway. So, Dale first, and then Ian. What would you like people that have been listening to this podcast today to take away or start to do as a result of listening to this podcast? Dale.
Yeah, thank you, Danny, and thank you everyone for listening to us today. I'd like to take us back to history. Henry Beecher, he wrote the Ad Hoc Committee of the Harvard Medical School, which gave us the concept of brain death, and that was in 1968. He was the first endowed chair of anesthesiology in the world and the founder of the first ICU at Massachusetts General Hospital. So I'd put it to all the listeners that this is our responsibility, the concept of neurological criteria, the maintaining the safety of it. It came from anesthesia and intensive care, and we have to have ownership of it. And it's if we don't keep it safe, who will? And just to encourage you to read the code. And if you've got ideas and that, just to reach out to Ian and myself and others.
Great, thank you. And Ian, what would your takeaway be?
I would sum it up by saying decisions made in haste are often poor decisions, and there is no rush to get to that diagnosis. So by giving time, give certainty, and giving certainty leads to safety. And I think it gives a better patient relative experience. It allows time from adjustment of hope of functional recovery to the beginnings of a grief response. And how we handle that as a profession will have a profound effect on the relatives of the patient long after we've finished interacting with them. So I think be safe, be certain, be careful, be compassionate, and understand and accept that the vital role we have in delivering high quality end of life care, including the safety and certainty around the diagnosis of death.
Great. Thank you both. So, thank you so much, Dale and Ian, because it's been a really fascinating conversation about an area of medicine that might have seemed static, but actually has been evolving quite a bit, both in terms of the science and the ethics and the language. Thank you also to you, our listeners. We're going to add some more links to some of the guidance and information that we've discussed in the episode description. And if you'd like to listen to more podcasts like this, be sure to subscribe both to the RCOA's Anaesthesia on Air podcast and also to Vikram's podcast and leave a review whilst you're here. So thank you very much.